On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
What would it have been like to have been a young immigrant girl from Russia brought into the United States over a century ago, living in New England, looking for a job, struggling with her family, and being involved in the labor movements and in the socialist movement in the early part of the 20th century? What would it have been like? Well, we're very fortunate that we have some remarkable documents that have been published by the granddaughter of the woman who went through all of those things. Her name was Matilda Rabinowitz, and her book is Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a memoir from the early 20th century, with commentary and original drawings by Robin Henderson, who is going to be our guest today. This is from Cornell University Press. And Robin, thank you so much for joining us on the Bookshelf.
I'm really glad to be here, Dave. I'm delighted.
Well, thanks. I love history, but this is not a section of history about which I am particularly knowledgeable. So I'm always excited to learn new stuff. This is your maternal grandmother, correct? Matilda Rabinowitz.
Yes, yes. She was my mother's mother, and my mother was her only child.
Your mom's name was Vita?
Vita, yes.
It is certainly not just the immigrant experience that makes this a fascinating account, although there is that. What it was like for her to leave with her large family, come to the United States. She came from a territory known as the Pale, as in the old expression, beyond the Pale, right?
That's right. It was known as the Pale of Settlement, and it was where Jews were confined in Russia, which was then that part of Russia was now the Ukraine, and it was considered the Ukraine then too, but it was a property of Russia.
And she came from a large family. Her father came to the States. Let's see if I remember the sequence right. Her dad came to the U.S., worked for 5 years, scrimping and saving, trying to send money back to take care of the family and to arrange for tickets to bring his wife and all the kids along.
That's right, yeah. He saved half the money needed for the fare for my grandmother, her four siblings, and her mother to come. And after they arrived in the United States, he owed the second half that paid for their voyage to his lodge, which was an association of men that came from the Ukraine, from his part of the world, and it was a Jewish organization. They were all Jews.
Matilda, your grandmother, was Jewish in ancestry, but not a practicing Jew when she came to the United States. But she had lots of friends who were Jews and so forth. So she had a pretty interesting upbringing.
Yeah, she did. She actually did not go to Catholic school. That was my grandfather who was the
right.
Catholic.
Right, okay, sorry.
She went to public schools, both in Russia, until what would be the equivalent probably of the eighth grade here, and then for 1 year in Bridgeport, Connecticut, when she was probably, 14 or so, and started in the sixth grade, and then by the end of the year, she graduated from the eighth grade.
Now, she was very smart, though. The lack of formal education does not reflect in any way on her native savvy, on her intelligence, and on her ability to figure things out. By the time she's an adult, she speaks a number of languages, and because of that, she's able to do all sorts of things. And I know I'm getting ahead of the story a little bit, but I wanted to reiterate to people that she didn't drop out in the eighth grade because that's as far as she could go. She was a very smart woman. That's just as far as they were able to get her educated in those days in that place. And women being educated all the way to eighth grade was kind of an unusual thing in the Pale as well.
That's right. Yeah, and she, her schooling ended in Russia, and there was no possibility for her to go on. In the United States, she had to terminate at the eighth grade because the family needed her labor. They would not have been able to survive unless she and two of her brothers and her father and her mother all worked. And so that was an education in itself for her. But she, as you say, she was very, very intelligent, and she loved to read. She was very well read. She was self-taught, but very widely read in literature and history. And as you said, also she spoke a number of languages. And the last one that she learned was English, which she didn't learn until she was a teenager. And I was always amazed later on when I thought about it. Because as we were growing up, she seemed to sound perfectly, like she spoke English perfectly. In fact, she had a slight Boston accent, upper-class Boston accent, which I don't know where she picked that up, but she was really, really smart.
Now, she had dealings with all kinds of people. She came to the United States at 13 years old in 1900. It becomes pretty obvious early on that there's not much money. It's difficult for them finding places to live that they can afford, and so forth. And she goes to work in a factory, which was not an unusual thing in that day and time, right?
That's right. And I think we tend to forget that. We think that, you know, most women until our time were, you know, homemakers and housewives and so forth. And actually, that wasn't true. Most poor women worked. And my grandmother was certainly one of them.
There was a document that I ran across while doing some research online about your grandma that seemed to indicate that there's a fellow, Philip Foner, wrote a history of the labor movement in the United States. I've not read the 10 volumes, but I read some quotes from him, and he described her as middle class, but I don't know where he got that. Her whole working life, all this memoir that you have so meticulously put together and you explain as she transitions from place to place and from job to job, there never seemed to be a time when she actually would have certainly thought of herself as being middle class.
No, I don't think she did at all, and I think she would have been quite offended by that, by Foner saying that about her. But I think he may have thought that about her because he probably didn't read her memoir, even though it was available. It's been in the Wayne State Labor Archives since the Walter Reuther Library there at Wayne State University. It's been there since the 60s, so it was available for historians to look at, but never was published. But I think he thought she was middle class because she wrote so well. Her writing is professional-level writing, and she wrote all her life. And you would imagine that somebody who wrote that well would have a classy education and be, you know, come from a middle-class background, and that certainly wasn't the case.
Well, now, there were plenty of people that she met along the way. Some of them hired her who were very surprised to find out that she did not have a college degree because she was so articulate and carried herself so well and knew how to get along with all kinds of people.
Yeah, and I think she was very fortunate that she had relationships with all kinds of people. And a lot of times, people who were much more fortunate than she was, who agreed with her politics and admired her activism, gave her a hand, either offered her work or lent her money, sometimes gave her a place to stay. So, yeah, she did travel occasionally in middle-class circles, too, because she was so exceptional.
When did you first read her memoir? Like most grandparents, she probably didn't talk about a lot of her early life to you when you were a little kid. But so when did you figure out what kind of a big deal she really was?
Well, if a matter of fact, you're right. She didn't. In fact, when we were little, she used to love to tell us bedtime stories, and she would make up stories and you know, these little stories about little American children who lived in the North Woods of New Hampshire and harvested maple sugar in the winter time. And we would say, tell us about when you were a little girl in Russia, Nana. And she would just deflect our curiosity and go on about these lovely little children. And I think it was probably because she didn't like to revisit those times. I think it was probably rather painful, her growing up. But and so I had a vague notion of the fact that she was an immigrant, and I knew that she was a politically activist because she was very outspoken about her beliefs and her feelings about what was going on in the world during the time I was growing up. She was very much for civil rights. She was always for working people. But I guess it was not until after she died. I was 20 when she died, and so I did know her as an adult, and I knew that she had, you know, an unusual life, but it never really crossed my mind how much of a historical figure she really was until I read the memoir probably in my mid-20s or early 30s.
If you're just now joining us, we're talking to Robin Laguerre Henderson, who is the compiler be the right way of saying this? Because you've published your grandmother's memoirs, but you've had to organize them and you illustrated them with original drawings. It's not fair to just to say you were the editor, because there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I did offer a written commentary, but I think my real contribution to the story are the drawings.
Well, I do like the written commentary as well, because it kind of helps keep the story straight as you move from as you transition from place to place. The name of the book is Matilda Rabinowitz, Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a memoir from the early 20th century, and it's from Cornell University Press. What was it like for a young working woman in New England in those days? There were factories where one could find work, where women could find work. Even as little as I knew about the specific situations that your grandmother addressed in her memoirs and that you've put into her book, there's still an awful lot that surprised me. The wage being low was sadly not a surprise, but the kind of working conditions and the kind of jobs did.
Yeah, the hours were long, much longer than they are now, and we probably don't give enough credit to the labor movement for giving us the 40-hour week. And in some places in the world, it's 30 hours a week, also because of the labor movement. But yeah, she worked in a corset factory. We don't even have them anymore, but and I think it's funny because she never wore that garment. She really did not like constrictive underclothes, but she worked tedious jobs, doing the same operation over and over and over again. So, and she found it very, very difficult. And the other thing is that a lot of the girls, mostly women and girls that she worked with, weren't very interested in the things that Matilda was interested in. They read the funny papers while she was reading poetry and novels and history. And so even though she tried to organize some of her fellow workers at the time, she really didn't have much success until she joined the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW.
She didn't have a lot of good things to say about one of the founding members and the kind of the big dogs of the IWW, a fellow named Big Bill Haywood. I kind of get the feeling that he was one of those guys that liked to be acknowledged as a wonderful, great man, but didn't like to do a whole lot of work.
Yeah, there's some qualities that in him, at least the way she sees him, that remind me a bit of our president. He was full of bluster, and he, as she says, he really hated any kind of criticism. So, and she felt that his writing was not up to snuff. But so yeah, she kind of does a number on him, which I think might have made her very unpopular in some circles, because, you know, to many people, Haywood was a real hero. But she had little use for him. But some others, like Vincent St. John, who was the general secretary of the IWW, she greatly admired. And she admired the founder of the U.S. Socialist Party, Eugene Debs, greatly, too. I admired him all her life.
Now, interestingly enough, there seems to be a fair amount of infighting within the socialist movement. She describes some of the socialists who kind of became institutional socialists, if you will. They became mayors and so forth. She calls them post office socialists.
Yes, and sometimes they were called sewer socialists.
Yeah.
And that was because they believed in reforming the system rather than radically changing it. And she was a radical. And it's ever thus, isn't it, in political organizations. There's a left wing, a right wing, and maybe even more wings than that.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to be able to come together a lot of the time, and sometimes struggle among themselves more than they do with people who really have divergent opinions from them. So, and she does make quite an issue of that in her memoir from time to time.
I suppose if you're passionate about something, you expect everybody else to have the same sort of passion. And we might say that these post office socialists, these sewer socialists, had the idea of working within the system, reforming the system from within. But for your grandmother, that was an inadequate reaction. And for her, the thing was revolution.
Yeah, perfect description, inadequate. And revolution was what she was after. And I think that she maintained that perspective her whole life. I mean, I remember even having arguments with her. I was a kind of a liberal, and she was a radical. And now, as time wears on, I reflect on some of the disagreements that we had when I was younger, and I think, oh my God, she was right. What a little know-it-all I must have been.
I think we're all kind of little know-it-alls when we're young.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and how the lines shift from year to year. Something, you know, you look at some of the things that they espoused over 100 years ago, and say, well, of course we shouldn't have a 55-hour work week, and of course you shouldn't pay somebody $5 a month to do piecemeal work in a factory, of course you ought to have some sort of consideration for your workers and. And all, I'll be honest with you. Most of what I know about the early days of the labor movement had to do with disasters like the shirtwaist factory fire and things like that. Terrible things that happened, but there was an everyday sort of advantage taken of working class people, the working poor in those days, that was just sort of taken for granted. That, well, this is the way it's always been. Even though it hadn't always been that way, that's the way it was, and that's the way it was going to stay, until people like Matilda Rabinowitz stood up and said, no, this is not the way to do things.
Yes, and she had a great sympathy and feeling for those most benighted, the people at the bottom end of the scale. She organized, even though she was supposed to be an organizer in the textile unions for the IWW, she organized in many industry. She organized the first auto industry strike in Detroit in 1913 at Studebaker. And Ford, sometimes historians credit her with his giving his workers better pay, because he was afraid that the union was going to come in and organize his workers. So he kind of jumped it ahead and offered them more money than they expected to get.
Right, kind of a preemptive strike. But of course, the good thing is that because of your grandmother's work and others like her, he did so. Otherwise, he never would have.
Right, and I wanted to also mention that she was really one of two women organizers for the IWW during its heyday. The other is much better known, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who wrote a memoir herself and is often cited in history, particularly of histories of women in labor. But for some reason, Matilda has been kind of overlooked until now, and that was one of the reasons I really was interested in trying to get her memoir published.
Well, I think that's why it's important for us to read it. We need to realize that there were lots and lots of people that were working together most of the time, I think, toward a common goal of making things better for working women and working men in America. Too often we just kind of lump it into the movement and don't talk very much about the heroes within that movement. I think that's one of the things I enjoyed so much about reading your book, is to find out what it was like firsthand from the eyewitness of your grandmother, what it was like to work piecemeal in these things. One of the things that industrialization did was slowly but surely eradicate the artisan as an effective business force. Because if you can make 1,000 corsets a day, say, by using a couple of hundred people each doing one little task, it's hard for the artisan who makes underwear, say, one piece at a time and make it very special. It's hard for them to compete with the mass-produced stuff.
Yes, that's very true. And my grandmother really understood that very, very thoroughly. She even says at one point in her memoir, "I never saw anyone make a whole corset or half a corset or even a tenth of a corset." And then she talks about how destructive that alienation of labor was for her and the people that she worked among. And she had a great deal of admiration for artisans, for craftsmen, for people who did things with their hands. She was a great admirer of beauty. Even though her tastes and her needs were very simple, she always had beautiful things around her. She would get them at bargain prices or, you know, secondhand very often. She was one of the first people I ever knew who shopped all the time in secondhand stores. And she had a great admiration for beautiful things and also a great love of nature, which comes across, I think, in her writing.
Let me ask you this. Since you're an artist, you've been a painter for over 30 years. You've been an illustrator for about 6 years. It had to be a labor of love drawing these illustrations, creating these illustrations for this book. I'm sure it would have been easy to go on the internet and get permission to download photographs and things like that. And that wouldn't have been terrible. But it's so much more interesting because you've created something beautiful and artistic to go along with the words that your grandmother wrote.
Well, thank you for that. And I must say that Cornell University Press deserves a little bit of the credit because they did, or quite a lot, really, of the credit, because they did, you know, a beautiful job on the design of the book, and the drawings are beautifully reproduced. They're very clear and clean. And I really wanted them to look, to be reminiscent of illustrations that might have been done during the time that my grandmother was writing about.
Right.
And so I did look at artists who had done work like that in the past, people like Rockwell Kent and Lynn Ward, who were actually also artists who were radicals. And I thought that their drawings had a kind of power and directness and very strong graphic quality that I wanted Matilda's book to have.
Well, it is a beautiful book and fascinating reading. Now, it would be unfair if we did not mention that your grandmother was kind of a radical in her private life as well, in that she was an advocate of free love. She chose to have a child without being married at a time when that would have been very scandalous. When the father of this child came along, your grandfather, she recognized that although he was a man who had great possibilities, he didn't seem to live up to him very much.
No, he was an actor as well as an activist and a labor leader himself, or an organizer himself. But he did not have the kind of integrity, I think, that Matilda did. And you're right. I think it's another facet of her strong and brave personality that she didn't believe in marriage. I remember her telling me when I was a young woman, "Oh, Bobsy," is what she called me, "Bobsy. Bobsy, marriage is a corrupt institution," she said. And I don't think she'd be too happy about the fact that her granddaughter is happily married.
We'll just keep that our little secret then.
Okay. But she was brave. I mean, to have a child at that time without a husband, never having had a husband, she really had to conceal that, and she didn't want it widely known. She felt that it made her uncomfortable to have her private life scrutinized, and there's a kind of a funny section in the book about that, too, with the discovery of the love letters between my grandfather and her. But she had all these facets that I think make her a fascinating character, even for today's women. I think she seems quite modern in many ways.
Yeah, I absolutely. I have them, even though she came before the flappers, I have the feeling that she would have been pretty comfortable having been a young girl in the 1920s. And not that she was old in the 1920s, but she was too young to be a flapper. Too old to be a flapper, but I think she would have been comfortable among them and their ideas about things.
Yeah, she was too old and maybe a little too serious to be a flapper.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. I didn't want to insult you, but she seemed like an awful serious person to do something as frivolous as have that kind of fun. But she was a very serious and a very intelligent woman, and she certainly makes for fascinating reading. And to think about the things that were considered radical that the labor movement was involved in over 100 years ago and now are taken for granted, You're right that when we observe Labor Day, we have to remember it's not just the last unofficial day of summer or just another day to barbecue. That it's to honor people like Matilda Rabinowitz, who stood up and said it's not fair for people to get paid so poorly when you're obviously making a lot of money doing this. There has to be a more equitable way of taking care of your employees and treating them better.
Yeah, I agree. She really, really was an advocate for workers and for women. And I think she really would have been felt that the immigrant stories that we're hearing today were sound very familiar to her, too.
Yeah, well, we're a nation of immigrants, and we forget that to our detriment. Robin, is there anything else that you wanted to tell us? I know we've just got a few moments here left. Your websites or anything like that?
Yeah. I do have a website. It's robinhenderson.com. And Henderson is spelled H-E-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. And the book is published by Cornell University Press, and I just want to give a shout-out to them because I think they did a beautiful job.
Yeah, it really is a visually beautiful book as well as fascinating reading for your mind. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today. Robin Laguerre Henderson did commentary and original drawings for the book that she has published through Cornell University Press that was based on the memoirs that her grandmother wrote, Matilda Rabinowitz, Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a Memoir from the Early 20th Century. And once again, check her website, Robin with two B's, Henderson.com. You can probably check Cornell.edu as well. Robin, thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you, David, and thank you for having me.
Our thanks again to Robin Henderson, compiler, the commentator, and the original illustrator of Matilda Rabinowitz, Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a Memoir from the Early 20th Century, from Cornell University Press. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks again for listening, and God bless.